All right, great to be with you again. Enjoyed getting to chat with some of you. Now we're going to talk about the men, how to make men great again. A little slogan I came up with, you never heard anything like it. That's when you know the speaker's really running out of creativity when he opts for that kind of thing. but seriously, everybody today wants to know, what is wrong with men? What is happening to our men? There's a complex issue here. One problem is, I think there's an unfair tendency to blame men for a lot of things that are not really their fault. One thing we should understand is that there have been times in history when women were considered to be more sinful than men, where women were considered in general to be temptresses and vixens. But today we have the opposite problem. That was a problem, but today we've got the opposite problem. Today, there's a tendency to treat women like angels who hardly ever sin, while viewing men as demons who do almost nothing but sin. Men are viewed as the root of all evil. You know, it's interesting. I say women are treated as angels. In Scripture, angels are always male, or at least masculine. But so often in pop culture now, angels are portrayed or depicted as females. And this, I think, kind of gets at the issue. In a lot of marriage counseling sessions, I've seen this play out. It's just assumed that the man is to blame for everything that goes wrong in the marriage. The man is the scapegoat. And so the whole marriage counseling process gets focused on how to fix the man. And I don't doubt that men certainly cause a great deal of marriage problems, but it overlooks the fact that women do too. Or think about how Mother's Day and Father's Day play out in churches. My church doesn't, we follow the ecclesiastical calendar, not the Hallmark calendar, so we don't do anything with these days. And I think that's probably for the best. But there are a lot of churches that do. And if you compare, say, Mother's Day sermons to Father's Day sermons in churches that do that kind of thing, you'll see a really sharp contrast. On Mother's Day, the moms are praised and honored. They're given flowers. And no mother is criticized at all. No mother is going to be criticized. No one suggests even the possibility that some moms might be abusive or wicked. You would get in trouble even for suggesting that half of all moms are below average. Nobody points out that some moms are not even showing up for the job because they're so busy chasing their career success or something else to invest in their children. The sins of women rarely get called out in church. And if a pastor is so bold as to point out publicly certain sins that women are prone to, you can be almost assured that there will be several white knights in the congregation who will come forward to the defense of these ladies and criticize the pastor for being so harsh with these delicate, angelic creatures. Now, compare that to how men get treated in church. On Father's Day, dads get scolded, they get called out, they're told to step it up. They're often berated and challenged. No one thinks twice about criticizing dads. Dads are fair game. Or I could go on with this, but think about how fathers and husbands are presented in popular culture compared to women. Okay, the man is always an idiot. If he's a family man, he's an idiot. He's just a buffoon. This is how men are presented. But moms are always presented as omnicompetent, capable of anything and everything. There's just this really sharp contrast between the way that the family man is presented and the way that, say, wives and mothers or just women in general are presented. So that's one issue. We've got a gender imbalance when it comes to how we see the sins or the problems of men compared to women. We have a tendency in our day, and again, it hasn't always been this way. Again, at times in the past, you could say we had the opposite problem. But today we have a tendency to minimize women's sins and to protect them from any kind of conviction or challenge, and we do the opposite with men. In fact, think about this. I'll just go a little bit more with this because this is, I think, worth pursuing a little bit further. It's very easy for us to list the typical sins of men. I mean, they're just out there for everybody to see. Just look at Donald Trump. You know, his sins are out there for everybody to see. You know, sins like lust or pride or anger or laziness, these would be typical male sins. Everybody knows what they are. And we have no problem talking about them as characteristic male sins. But what if you were to ask, what are the characteristic feminine sins? The characteristic sins of women? A lot of people would have a hard time producing any kind of list like that. Or if they even thought about it mentally, they might be really reluctant to share it publicly. But the thing is, Scripture does produce such a list. Scripture has no hesitations in calling out women for their particular feminine sins, just as it calls out men for those peculiarly masculine sins. So I just talked about this, and you know, in the last lesson, we talked about women who nag and women who do not obey their husbands. That's a common feminine sin for women to be insubmissive. Women gossip. Men can gossip too, but it's more characteristic of women. Women are perhaps more prone to deception, to be more taken in by what Scripture calls old wives' tales. Who's more likely to look at a horoscope, a man or a woman? Women are far more likely to hold a grudge than men are, to not let something go. They're slower to forgive. They tend to manipulate more. Men might be more prone to violence. Men are given over to physical warfare more than women, but women are given more over to psychological warfare, things like manipulation, those kinds of tactics. Or think about this. I've already mentioned mothers, but think about this situation, single moms. There are very few groups of people in our culture who are so continually lauded as single moms. But rarely does anybody ask, how did single moms end up in the situation they're in? Sometimes it's tragedy and it's no fault of their own. That's certainly clear, and we want to stress that. But a lot of times it is because of bad decisions that these women have made. And nobody will point that out. Hardly anybody will criticize women for bad decisions they've made that have put them and their children in a very difficult place. Same kind of thing happens very often when we talk about abortion. We will minimize the sins of the woman involved. We might blame the man, we might blame the doctor, but a lot of people are very reluctant to blame the woman. And sometimes the woman is a victim of various forces that have pressured her into getting an abortion, but very often the woman does it. You've even got this shout your abortion movement where women will brag about it. That kind of thing is out there. It's very wicked. These are very wicked women. The reality is there is plenty of sin to go around for men and women both. Men and women are both sinners. You know, we might say you want equality. Well, okay, here it is. Men and women are equally fallen, equally depraved if left to themselves. Some of the ways we sin are the same. Some of the ways we sin are sex specific. But we are equally depraved, and our teaching in the church ought to reflect that. But the church in general today tends to go easier on women than on men. And I think a big part of this, a big reason for this, is because we have made feminine expectations the norm for the Christian life. And the cultures of our churches have become heavily feminized. And so we've got another problem here. I'll describe it this way. Highly masculine men, men who are robustly masculine. A lot of times these are men who, say, work in the trades or work blue-collar jobs, but it's certainly not limited to that. But very often, men who are robustly masculine find nothing in church attractive to them or compelling for them. Pastors for centuries now have been regarded as the third sex. Okay, present company accepted, okay? I'm not, you know, but traditionally this has been true. Obviously, pastors are not women, but they're not accepted in the world of men either because they're so effeminate. So they're somewhere in between, and we kind of have this image of the pastor hanging out with all the old church ladies while the real men are out doing other kinds of stuff. And you know, and it's the guy that's kind of mousy and effeminate. You know, that's the one that becomes the pastor. That's often the stereotype, and it's the stereotype because it's so often happened over the last several centuries. Evangelical publishing is almost entirely marketed towards women, even when the books are written for men. Even when the books are written for men, they are marketed so wives and moms will buy them for their husbands and sons. Church tends to be a feminized or effeminate environment. This is very true of worship in many churches. Again, not this church, thankfully, and not my church back home. But this is true in many churches. The worship is highly emotionalized. It's very effeminate. The music's very effeminate. We don't really know how to minister to men in masculine ways or how to deal with men who are rough around the edges, as it's sometimes put. Fatherlessness, of course, is a huge part of this. Absent fathers or failed fathers or effeminate fathers leave young men without masculine mentorship, without anyone to teach them what it means to be a man. And so we've got a lot of men who have not made the transition from boyhood to manhood the way that they should, because they haven't had anybody teaching them what that means. They haven't had a real man who knows what he's doing, who knows what that's like, who knows what he's talking about, who can help these boys transition into men. So there are all these issues that I think we have to reckon with. But even if we accept all of that, we've still got a very specific issue with men we need to address. Men today, Christian men as much as non-Christian men, are confused and lost when it comes to understanding what masculinity is. In fact, a lot of men, and this is maybe even more true in the church than outside the church, but a lot of men are embarrassed by masculinity. We have men who are ashamed of their own masculinity. And so they seek to bury that masculinity, to hide it. And the church, again, has been very complicit in this. Feminism originally set out to masculinize women, to make women more like men. But of course, women can't become fully like men. And so there was a second step to this process that had to be added. As women are becoming more like men, feminism said, you know what? Men need to be made more like women. We need to feminize men. And that is exactly what has happened. Men have been largely feminized. And so the goal today really is androgyny. It's gender fluidity. It's a unisex society. When I talked about women in the earlier talk, I gave you some anecdotes. I want to do that here again. I want to give you some anecdotes. This is from Matthew Crawford's book, Why We Drive. Matthew Crawford is, I don't have any reason to think he's a Christian, but he's got a lot of really interesting things to say and on all kinds of topics, and a lot of them very much relate to men. He's probably my favorite contemporary philosopher. But he was at a big event on the West Coast, and it included a costume party. And listen to how he describes how the men and women dressed for this costume party. At the bottom of the hill, I saw a group of grown men dressed as Teletubbies. And another group of grown men loitering near a giant baby carriage dressed only in diapers. While the men seemed to favor themes of self-infantilization, the women contestants wore costumes of empowerment, black jeans, wife beaters, and motocross helmets. I had the sense of having entered a game of signs with rules of play that were pretty clear to the initiated. In the game of Portland circa 2018, the rules seemed to require the men to signal innocuous and the women to signal fierce. He goes on, he says, what's happening here? Men are waving a white flag in the battle of the sexes, with the expectation that such gestures will win approval from the women. In the 18th century, very similar norms prevailed in the ruling class of a society that was about to collapse. These men are emasculating themselves, thinking that that will ingratiate themselves to the women. And the women, meanwhile, are presenting themselves in very masculine ways, very powerful ways. And what happened in this costume party really is a picture of what's happening in our culture at large. We've got huge swaths of men in our culture who have been infantilized. They have been effectively castrated. They are weak. They are effeminate. They have almost nothing in common with the men of three or four generations ago who never would have dressed or acted this way because they had a deep sense of what it means to be a man, a deep sense of duty, a deep sense of duty to live out their God-given masculinity. But today's men have been brainwashed into thinking that all expressions of that kind of traditional masculinity are toxic. They've been trained by feminist moms and in feminist-dominated schools. They've been trained by rock music and by country music, this kind of music, we may not think about this, but it often sends very feminist messages. Men have been taught to think that if they are soft and effeminate and sensitive, and that if they emote like women, that this will actually make them attractive to women. That by becoming more like women, they can attract women, and it is a lie. Remember what I said earlier? Polarity is what drives attraction. The feminine is actually drawn to the masculine and vice versa. But that's been lost in our culture. It's been brainwashed out of a lot of men. Let me continue on. This is, again, Matthew Crawford. Here he talks about a couple of Kia ads. This is for the Kia SUV. It's a car. I've not actually seen the ads, but listen to how he describes these commercials. Advertising offers a useful window onto the state of the culture. A woman is behind the wheel of a Kia SUV, her husband in the passenger seat. That's symbolic right there. The kids in the back. They have arrived at a crowded event and are looking for parking. The husband, looking backwards, says, "We should take that spot." The woman says nothing and keeps driving. A strong and silent type, she is used to keeping her own counsel in the face of such capitulation. But we see the play of contempt on her face and hear a voiceover that is her sarcastic internal monologue. "Yeah, or we could drive back home, park, and walk here." To the alarm of her husband, she proceeds forward and off the pavement. She'll be the risk taker. Okay. The SUV climbs a steep berm of grass and stops. She has made her own parking spot. "Somebody in this family's got to wear the pants," she says to herself. In another Kia ad, a family is leaving a football game in which their young son has played. The husband, beaming with supportiveness, says to the son, "You played a great game today, buddy." Once again, we hear the woman's silent thoughts from the driver's seat. "Not really. He's just not good." In these ads, it falls to the woman to bring certain energies that we still associate with men in our backsliding moments. The power of decisive action and risk-taking, an instinctive contempt for weakness, and clear-sighted disregard for feel-good fluff in the name of reality. Good for her, as she rightly says, "Somebody's got to wear the pants." Okay, this kind of role reversal is all over our culture. It's just incredibly common, and it's obviously a huge problem. Where women are taking on these more masculine characteristics, displaying a kind of masculine energy, while men have become effeminate. The same kind of dynamic is at work in superhero movies now, where the woman is the superhero. And what I find interesting about this is supposed to be good for women, that you've got women in these roles where basically they're the ones now who beat everybody up, including men, and maybe rescue the man. The problem with, well, there's a lot of problems with it, but one problem is it does not honor women as women. It says really the only way for women to be honored is to do what men would traditionally do. Women can't be honored in their own roles. They've got to do a man's thing. They've got to do man stuff to be honored. And so basically what you have in these superhero movies now is the woman does exactly what the man would have done. You know, exactly the same things are happening just now with a woman's body instead of a man's body. And of course, when you look at it, you can tell how ridiculous this is. There's no way a woman with this particular figure and so forth could beat up all these guys and that kind of thing. It's just utterly absurd. It's more absurd than superhero movies usually are. But there's nothing about this that actually honors women as women. There's nothing that honors them in their femininity. When the Bible gives us female heroines, what are they known for? There's something very feminine about their exploits. And so it's not just that they're doing what a man would normally do. They're doing something great as a woman in a womanly kind of way. There's another place where Matthew Crawford mentions how many even straight men today are adopting gay mannerisms. And this is really interesting to explore. Straight men who act like they're gay. We talk about metrosexuals. I mean, that may be a manifestation of this. Why is this happening? Well, it's because our culture considers heterosexual men to be dangerous and toxic. And this is especially true on university campuses where there is supposedly a rape culture where every man is considered to be a threat to every woman. Well, let me rephrase that. Every straight man is considered to be a threat to every woman. And so on these university campuses, you know, heterosexual men are assumed to be rapists and abusers. And so how do men respond to this? How do they deal with this? Well, many of them have responded by essentially acting gay. Listen to what Crawford says here. He says, "The class of young men who go to elite colleges feel this long before they arrive, that their masculinity is a problem. And it surely plays a role in the project of adolescent self-fashioning." You know how adolescents, teenagers, and maybe into your 20s as well, you're kind of fashioning an identity for yourself. What's happening with these men who go to these elite colleges? "Who has not noticed that stereotypically gay-sounding speech and other affectations have gone mainstream, adopted by young males who are not, in fact, homosexual? This would seem to be a case of performative homosexuality." Crawford says, "I take it to be the waving of a cultural white flag with respect to one's own masculinity by which one declares oneself a non-threat and seeks approval for this gesture." You've got this man here waving the white flag saying, "We're not even going to try to be masculine anymore. We give up. We're going to act like we're gay. We're going to act effeminate because we think that's the only way we can possibly be accepted. That's the only way anybody can feel safe around us." Men have surrendered their masculinity. They're scared to act like men or pursue a woman like a man, like men have traditionally done, because that might be interpreted as harassment. So young men today are almost completely disconnected from their own masculinity. And I can tell you that, you know, if you're an older man and you're not around younger men, you may not realize the magnitude, the severity of this problem. But if you are around guys who are teenagers or you know, in their early 20s, maybe in their mid-20s, this is a huge, huge issue where men are completely alienated from their own masculinity. Let me give you another example. This is a mock conversation, so I made this up. But you can think of this as a representative conversation in a pastor's office between a typical feminized evangelical pastor and a husband in his congregation who's been sent there by his wife. Most likely, is seeking help on being a better husband. Okay, and this is how the conversation might go. Again, this is representative of the kinds of things that I've heard over the years in, you know, that's been relayed about counseling sessions or in sermons. So this husband who's read his Bible and he knows what Ephesians 5 says about the husband's headship, he knows what 1 Peter 3 says about the woman's submission, these Bible passages, he comes to his pastor and he says to the pastor, "The Bible says I'm supposed to be the head of my wife. What does that mean? What am I supposed to do?" The pastor says, "Well, it doesn't mean you are a tyrant bossing her around." The husband says, "I never thought that. I just want to know what it does mean. The Bible says I am the head and she is supposed to submit to me." Pastor says back, "Well, submission doesn't mean she's a doormat or a slave to you. That's for sure." And the husband says, "Well, okay, I didn't think that. I hardly ever tell my wife what to do anyway. She knows she's not my slave. But what does it mean to be the head? That's what I want to figure out. That's what I need to know." The pastor says, "Well, it means you're supposed to be a servant leader." The husband says, "Okay, now we're getting somewhere. A servant leader. That gives me something to work with. What exactly does it mean to be a servant leader? How do I lead and serve at the same time?" Pastor says to him, "You love her like Christ loves the church." The husband says, "Okay, I've been trying to do that. Maybe some specific examples would help." The pastor says, "Well, do the dishes." Husband says, "Okay, what else?" Pastor says, "Well, basically do what she tells you to do." The husband says, "Okay, so like I'm supposed to submit to her?" And the pastor says, "Yeah, something like that." And the husband says back, "Okay, so if I submit to her, does that mean she's really my head and I am actually her helper? What about all those passages that seem to teach a husband has real authority over his wife?" And all the pastor can do is give a blank stare back. Now I want to interrupt the conversation right there before it gets any worse, because it's spiraling down into a complete disaster very quickly. But do you see what's happened here? And again, this conversation is all too typical. Through a convoluted process of reasoning that is all too common, headship has been turned into its opposite. Servant leadership, which you could make a case for biblically, but here, servant leadership has actually become subservience. This marriage has been decapitated. The head has been cut off. The man has been castrated. Think about the situation he's in now. If he does try to tell his wife what to do, "Honey, I think we ought to discipline the kids this way. Honey, I think we ought to school our kids this way next year." What can she do in response? She can always say back to him, "Well, you're just being a tyrant. You're not serving me. You're just trying to boss me around. I'm not your doormat. Didn't you hear the pastor say that?" And so effectively, she can take that pastor's counsel and use it as an excuse to never have to actually obey or submit to her husband. Servant leadership has neutered the man. The man's supposed to be a servant leader, but here, the servant part has canceled out the leadership part. And so the man has become the helper, and the helper has become the head. And we've got really what I would call a satanic role reversal in the name of biblical fidelity. And the fact that this is done in the name of fidelity to the scriptures makes it all the worse. What it means is this marriage that is supposed to be a Christian marriage is no different than what a feminist might have with her lackey husband. But this kind of thing happens all the time in the church's teaching. Just, you know, you can go out there and listen to sermons preached in otherwise conservative, faithful, reformed evangelical churches on passages like Ephesians 5, and the pastor will say something just like this. The wife's submission to the husband dies the death of a million qualifications. So when you actually get down to it, there's really nothing left there. She doesn't have to submit at all. The husband's authority has been subverted and negated, and the wife has been put in the position of rule functionally. Now, note, in this scenario, the husband will still be responsible. If something goes wrong, he'll still bear the blame. Even though he doesn't have the authority to do anything about it, he's going to be responsible for it. Now, in this setting, in this scenario, it's no wonder so many men today see marriage as a bad deal. It's all responsibility, no authority. There's no real headship. Instead, what happens? The wife's expectations become the norm. Her feelings become the standard by which he will be judged and evaluated. And if she says he's not being a good husband, what pastor's going to argue with her and tell her that the problem's really her? It's not going to happen very often today. So what do we need to do? Well, it's time for men to reclaim what headship really means, to reclaim the authority that is theirs by divine right. But this is only going to work for men in their homes if pastors in the church are there to back them up and actually teach on this. Pastors are going to have to teach that wives really do have to obey their husbands. They really do have to submit. And while a good husband will, yes, listen to his wife, he will still lead her. And the listening won't cancel out the leading. Reclaiming headship for husbands is part of this wider project of reconstructing masculinity for all men. What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a man? In 1 Kings chapter 2, David is on his deathbed, and he gives his final parting words to Solomon, his son. These are his deathbed words, his parting words, his final words. He says to Solomon, "Be strong and show yourself a man." Be strong and show yourself a man. Be strong and be a man. Those were David's final words to his son. What did he mean? David was a man. He had his failings, certainly, but he was a true man, a model man overall, a man after God's own heart, and he wants Solomon, his son, to be a man as well. David and Solomon, taken together, represent a holistic view of biblical manhood. So what are they each known for? If we take a profile of David and a profile of Solomon and what they did right and combine them in David and Solomon, we really have a biblical picture, a biblical portrait of what manhood is all about. So what is David best known for? He's best known for fighting. In fact, David really wanted to build a house for God, but he wasn't allowed to because he was a man of war and the temple needed to be built by a prince of peace. So he doesn't get to build the temple. David was a fighter. He took down Goliath. He rallied troops in the wilderness to hold off Saul. He fought the Philistines. He was always courageous in battle. David was known as a fighter. What about Solomon? Solomon is best known for building. Solomon also had his failings. We know all about that. But he's best known for his building project. He gets to build the temple. He undertakes this massive building project that required all kinds of stamina, competency, and wisdom, that required skill as much as it required virtue. So you take David and Solomon together, what do you have? You have David the fighter, and you have Solomon the builder. What's it mean to be a man? It means to fight and to build. Or to use the picture from Nehemiah, you've got a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other. What is manhood all about? Sword and trowel. That's manhood. That's the blueprint for masculinity. Now, what I want to do in the balance of time I've got left is unpack some of those key qualities that make men men. The fact that David says to Solomon, "Be a man," means you can be biologically male and still fail at manhood. You can actually deny what you are. Solomon is obviously biologically a man, so why would David say, "Be a man"? He's already a man. What does that mean? Well, there's being a man, and then there's being a man. There's being a man biologically, and then there's building on that to actually act out your masculinity in ways that are faithful to who you are. And not all men do that. That's why David gives this exhortation. It's not enough to be male. You have to be manly or masculine. Some men are not real men. Some men are effeminate. Effeminacy is a huge problem, as we've already seen. Soft men are a huge problem in the church today. And again, that's because our culture does so much to neuter men, to make men weak, to make men feel like their masculinity is toxic. Men need to be masculine without permission. Masculine even if the culture is opposed to it. Men need to be masculine because God calls them to it and created them for it. We men have got to stop sabotaging ourselves. Most of what we need to say about manhood used to be common knowledge. Used to be, you know, boys grew up and became men and just knew all this stuff. Now we've got to talk about it because it's been beaten out of us. We've been so brainwashed by our culture. It's not the case anymore that we just know what manhood is intuitively. We've attacked masculinity so much in our culture. It's interesting. I've read a lot of Christian books on manhood, and I've noticed a theme. Many of these books focus almost entirely on virtue, and they say almost nothing about skill. So I'll put it this way. These books tend to focus on being a good man, but they ignore what it takes to be good at being a man. You understand that distinction? Being a good man versus being good at being a man? Virtue on the one hand, skill on the other. Virtue on the one hand or competency on the other. The result is that many of these books, what they say about manhood is actually very thin. They actually do very little to develop a gender-specific piety, a specifically masculine form of discipleship. All the virtues they focus on are actually virtues that women should focus on too. You know, you'll read a book on manhood that talks about how men should be loving and thankful and kind and humble. We'll change the cover of the book, change a few illustrations, and it could just as easily be a book on womanhood as on manhood. It doesn't really get into anything specifically masculine. It does nothing to develop specifically masculine traits. Again, so we're not just good men, but we're good at being men. And I should add here, when men and women do share certain traits or certain virtues, they're going to be expressed differently in men and women. I touched on this last night, but I'll mention it here again. There are some traits, like love or kindness, that are not unique to a man or unique to a woman. Both men and women should be loving and kind. But what we need to keep in mind is that love and kindness will be expressed differently. Love and kindness will be expressed uniquely in men compared to women. So men will express these things in masculine ways. There'll be a masculine form of love for the man and then a feminine form of love for the woman, or a masculine form of kindness for the man and a feminine form of kindness for the woman. Men and women love differently. Mothers and fathers love differently. Husbands and wives love one another differently. One other thing, true manhood is not just a matter of virtues. It's also a matter of skills. I hinted to this already, but let me say something else about it. Again, all too often, accounts of manhood, you know, even in our circles, I would say, maybe especially in our circles, focus on virtue to the exclusion of skill. And the result is a very Gnostic view of manhood, a view of manhood that has very little to do with the body or working with your hands or physical strength. We need to understand there's something, there's a physicality to manhood that has to be captured. A masculine way of being present in the world. Manual manhood, we might call it. The kind of manhood that is expressed in what a man does with his body in the world. Remember, David and Solomon are our profiles of manhood here. What do? What are they known for? Fighting and building. Those are intensely physical things. They're things that rearrange and transform the world. Biological manhood is the foundation of being a man, but there's more to it. So let me get into this, and I just want to give you a list here. I'm going to run through some things. I'll just see how far I get in the time I have, and then we'll leave it at that. But I want to give you a list here of some qualities or traits that are specific to men. Not that there's not overlap with women, but these things are specifically masculine, and they need to be displayed. If a man is going to be a good man who is good at being a man, these are the things he's going to have to show. So first, strength. That's what David said to Solomon. Be strong and be a man. So strength. There's got to be strength. Manhood is associated with strength just as womanhood is associated with beauty. Okay? Women are associated with beauty in Scripture. Men are associated with strength. Proverbs 20, verse 29. The glory of young men is their strength. The glory of old men is their gray head. Physicality matters to men. Male heroes are heroes always because of some physical exploit, because of their physical presence in the world. I don't think every man needs to be a bodybuilder or anything like that, but I do think every man needs to be a steward of his physical condition. Strength matters to men. It's good for men to do things like lift weights or play sports, things that cultivate physical ability. It's a great way to develop masculine energy, to focus masculine energy. It helps a man fulfill his role as defender and protector. Our society is so safe today that many men have forgotten this. We've somewhat lost the sense that we might have to physically defend ourselves or our loved ones, but we ought to be able to do so. At least in principle, men should be committed to that. Now, we also need to keep in mind there are other forms of strength that matter besides just physical strength. Old men can still be manly even when their physical prowess diminishes. There's a kind of intellectual strength or wisdom that men should have as well. An old man's wisdom, his intellectual experience and strength, indeed, should more than compensate for his lack of physical strength or his loss of physical strength. Remember Proverbs 20:29. The glory of the old man is his gray head, a symbol of his wisdom. A wise man has a world within himself, a wealth of knowledge and experience he can offer to others. Men with wisdom are endlessly fascinating. Men with wisdom have countless stories to retell. And so men should cultivate both the physical and the intellectual. Men should strive to be strong in body and strong in mind because men need strength. Masculinity is all about strength. It's all about power. Men are supposed to be powerful. And again, there are other forms even than just physical strength and intellectual strength. We could talk about other forms of strength too, but these are the two most prominent, and they're really the ones that David and Solomon display. David and Solomon show both kinds of strength in their lives, and this gives them their depth as men. So strength. Here's a second quality or trait men must show: confidence. David and Solomon are both confident men. And you see their confidence come out in all kinds of ways. Neither is anxious. Neither is anxious in the midst of a great battle or in the midst of a great project. David wasn't anxious about facing Goliath. Solomon was not anxious about this great building project he undertook with the temple. Confident men can be direct. They can be disagreeable when they need to be. They're looked to for leadership because their confidence, the confidence they have in themselves, inspires the confidence of others. Confidence gives rise to decisive decision making. If men are going to lead, they need confidence. They have to be able to make decisions with confidence, including decisions that will draw criticism, including decisions that might hurt other people's feelings. They can't let empathy get in the way in those situations. The confident man will weigh, he will consider, and then he will choose, and he won't look back. One of the things actually that helps man grow in confidence is his past experience. And yes, many of his experiences might involve failure, but he's able to make a confident decision, a decisive decision, because of the experience he has accumulated. David and Solomon at their best were both decisive men. And that's why they're both looked to as leaders. Indecisive men cannot lead because they lack confidence. Others do not put confidence in them. Confidence gives rise to another trait here, courage. Courage is closely related to confidence. It's another manly virtue, and it's necessary to many manly tasks. Men who are cowards are clearly failing as men. One of the ways that God curses a people is by making the soldiers, the warriors of that nation, cowardly. And it says that in the time of battle, they will flee like women. We don't expect women to exercise the same kind of courage that we expect and ought to demand from our men. Because men have this confident courage, we expect men to take risks that women would not. Now, men shouldn't be stupid about this. You know, you can go online and, you know, you can look up, you know, why women live longer, and you'll see men doing all these stupid things. Okay, I'm not really saying that. But taking calculated risks, that's essential to manhood. Having an almost irrational confidence, which ultimately comes from knowing that God has made you a man and made you to do manly things. That's where that irrational confidence comes from. David had a completely irrational level of confidence when he faced Goliath. And of course, it paid off. And this is something that's widely recognized. I mean, non-Christians recognize this too. You know, the story of Spartan women who would tell their sons going off into battle, you know, return with your shield or on it. You know, those are your choices. Courage makes men indomitable. Men who are manly will not back down from challenges. They will not be easily intimidated. They will even get a thrill from facing their fears and overcoming them. Such men are given to constant self-improvement. They're not afraid of criticism because they know they need to be better. They need to do better. So they accept that kind of criticism because it's that criticism that allows you to construct a better version of yourself. There are men who can stand up to bullies. Not incidentally, confidence is also the single most important quality for a man in attracting a woman. Women are drawn to masculine confidence. This is true for a lot of reasons, but confidence is what allows a man to maintain frame in his relationship with a woman, which is essential to leading her. If he doesn't have confidence, he's going to fall into her frame, and she's going to be the one actually doing the leading. He's got to maintain frame, which takes confidence. Then she will live inside his frame, which is what God wants. Frame is just another word for headship. A woman will know that she cannot control a confident man, and that raises his value and worthiness in her eyes, which, again, is the opposite of what a lot of men have been taught to expect or how they've been taught to think about attraction between the sexes. But it's precisely that confidence that keeps a man from being controlled by a woman that raises his value in her eyes, because now she knows this is a man who's going to be able to take care of things. He's going to be able to take care of me if things go wrong, if things go badly. This is a man who can hold it together. She needs to know that she is with a man who's got confidence that external circumstances cannot shake. And so the man's confidence gives his wife security. A man who lacks confidence may arouse a woman's pity, but he will not arouse anything else in her. He will not arouse her in any other way. A lack of confidence can be seen in negativity or despair or complaining or excuse making or being overly emotive or being hopeless or being too worrisome or too anxious. All of these things are very unattractive qualities in a man. They're unattractive to a woman, but frankly, they're unattractive to other men as well. They're repellent. Confidence makes you calm, cool, and collected under pressure. Again, think of David facing Goliath. We expect men to be able to go into high-pressure situations and face them and perform. Men have the burden of performance. Men have to perform. They have to do things. That takes confidence. Okay, let me keep going here. Other qualities. Men must be assertive and ambitious. I put these together, assertive and ambitious. And here's a good test. When you think of ambition, there's a good chance you think of something negative, something sinful. Okay, but Paul commands ambition. In fact, he commends men who are ambitious in 1 Timothy chapter 3. He commends men who want to be church leaders, men who have this ambition to be church leaders. He commends that in 1 Timothy chapter 3. Now, he also in Philippians 2 recognizes there is sinful ambition or selfish ambition. But we got to remember, there is holy ambition as well. Ambition and assertiveness are forms of masculine energy that lead to action in the world and ultimately raise a man's status. Ambition and assertiveness are action-oriented. In a good man who is good at being a man, there will be a kind of holy competitiveness. He's going to have moxie and grit. These are classic masculine qualities. Have you ever known a man where everybody around him said, you know, that guy just makes things happen. That guy just knows how to get things done. You know, I've known some men who are really like this in the course of my life. And when you say that about a man, that man just makes things happen. He just gets things done. There's a kind of manliness in that. That's what men do. They make things happen. They get things done. When you speak about a man that way, you're acknowledging a man's drive. You're saying this is a man who creates momentum, a man who goes after his vocation. He goes after whatever God has called him to. He's a man on a mission. And this is another thing that defines manhood. A man is defined by his mission. He is intentional and purposeful in fulfilling his mission. David and Solomon are both defined by their missions very clearly. All true men are mission-driven. They want to make their mark in the world. They want to extend their dominion. You go back to Adam. Again, you find that God gave Adam a mission before he gave him a wife. And the wife gets incorporated into the mission. Too many men today make the woman the mission. But that doesn't lead anywhere. That doesn't do anything in the world. That doesn't affect things. The man needs a mission, and that will actually draw the woman in, and then she can submit. What's that word submission mean? It means she gets under his mission. She, you know, the very word itself, submission, tells you that. He's got a mission. She gets under it, on board with it, supporting him in it, helping him in it. Passive, low energy men, men who lack drive, men who are thin skinned and fragile, are failing as men. They're not in control of themselves, and so they can never take control of a situation. They can't be relied upon to get things done. They can't compete with other men. Okay, I'll further unpack this way. Men are dominion oriented. I've already touched on this, but masculinity translates into productivity. A man's got to do something with his life. He's got to make his mark on the world and make the world different in some kind of way. Men are created to shape and transform the world, to build things, to figure things out. Proverbs says this is what kings do. They seek out the things God has hidden. That's the glory of a king. So think about this. Almost all discoverers and inventors and explorers have been men. Women don't innovate or build or explore or discover or transform the world in the same way that men do, in the same way that men classically have. I mean, Camille Paglia, who describes herself as a feminist, says if it were up to women, we'd all still be living in grass huts. But men don't do that. Men figure things out. They build things. They transform things. They figure out how to build skyscrapers and roads and space rockets. It's man's nature to do this kind of thing, to explore, to discover, to invent, to bring order out of chaos. So lazy men are not good at being men. Lazy men need to man up and get to work. Real men, if you're going to be strong and be a man, like David said to Solomon, you're going to have to be a worker. You're going to be disciplined. You're going to have drive and determination. You're going to have grit and moxie. You're going to be self-disciplined. This ties into man's role as provider. A man is to be a provider for himself and his family. Paul says if a man doesn't provide for his family, he's worse than an unbeliever. Men who are good at being men create value. And over time, that value becomes wealth. Manhood is functional. It does something. Men typically ought to know how to work with their hands. Paul says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, he says, work with your hands. And I think Paul really means it. I don't think we can just substitute brain labor for manual labor there. I mean, obviously it's fine if you work a desk job and work more with your brain than with your hands. That's fine. But even if that's the case, you ought to find things you can do with your hands. Men don't have to be involved in manual labor as their main vocation, but all men should be striving to be adept at basic physical or manual tasks as aspects of their dominion over the world. It is manly to work with your hands. Indeed, the further we as a culture get from manual work, the less significant the differences between the sexes are. One way to recover the differences between the sexes is to get back to doing manual labor of various sorts in our daily lives. I think this is something we ought to figure out how to do. Effeminate men will look down on manual labor and on handiwork. Genuine men embrace it as part of their manhood. Working with our hands requires us to submit ourselves to an objective reality outside of ourselves. You know, think about this. You know, think about trade schools compared to elite universities. You know, they don't have riots or safe spaces at trade schools. Okay, why not? Well, it's because in the trades, you learn very quickly that facts don't care about your feelings. You learn that the world is what it is. And if your ideology conflicts with the reality, that's too bad for your ideology. Okay? Unfortunately, people don't learn that in elite universities. And that's why they have all these crazy ideologies that don't correspond to reality. They're completely insulated. They live in a bubble, insulated from reality. I think we ought to take every Ivy Leaguer and go make him work a manual labor job as a mechanic or a plumber or an electrician. You know, at least one or two summers during the course of their college education, so they can encounter failure, and also so they can encounter the objective world outside of their own heads, where they learn, okay, I've got to submit to the way things are to make this work. I would guess that most people graduating from trade schools are immune to things like transgenderism or the homosexual agenda. Because mechanics, plumbers, electricians, they're putting male and female pieces or fittings together all the time. They know things only fit together a certain way. There's a lesson in there, but that's a lesson all of us need. Now, obviously, you can't be an expert in everything, but men should have a do-it-yourself kind of bent, a desire to master the physical world, to figure things out. It's the most basic form of dominion. It's where dominion begins. Dominion began in a garden. Adam's going to have to work with his hands. That's where it starts. We should never get totally past that. Manual competency matters. Again, think of David with his sling or with his musical instrument. Or think of Solomon as the foreman of a massive building project, overseeing that work, having to hire the workers and inspect the work that they've done and participated in some way in himself in building the temple. That is manly dominion. Passion. Do a little bit more here and then I'll wrap this up. Passion. There's a kind of masculine passion that is crucial to a man's life. Men have to be able to suppress their emotions to do their work. Say, on the battlefield, or in the operating room, or at the top of the crane. That doesn't mean a man becomes a block of wood. I'm not advocating for stoicism here. But men's brains are wired so they can be single-minded in ways that women cannot be. Men's brains are wired in such a way that they can suppress their emotions and focus on just one thing in a way that women generally can't. Men can often be intense in ways women don't really understand. They can have this kind of laser-like focus on something. This may be why men tend to have far more hobbies than women, because men are able to get very intense about certain things that interest them. And men should be continually striving for mastery and competency. They should be continually expanding their range of skills. You should never stop learning, because learning is just a way of furthering your dominion, expanding your dominion in the world. A man's passion should lead him to mastery. Think of the Renaissance man. This is a great picture. David was certainly a Renaissance man. I think Solomon was too. You read Proverbs, you find that Solomon was, you know, he was into everything. Solomon knew music and he knew animals and he knew architecture. These are true Renaissance men. They know something about everything. That should be the picture. A man's passion should lead him to mastery of the world. Every man should be an expert in something, and your range of expertise should expand over time as you age. Passion ties in with a man's dominion orientation. Proverbs 22:29 says it well. If you see a man skillful in his work, he will stand before kings. Why don't we write books on manhood that talk about that? Skill, competency, mastery. Let me give you one more here and then we're done. Conscientious. Conscientious. A man must be conscientious. The conscientious man is self-aware and therefore he takes responsibility for himself. Conscientiousness is not a biblical word, but I do think the Bible describes something very much like it. The conscientious man will practice stewardship. He will take initiative. He's reliable and trustworthy. The conscientious man knows how to read the room. He's got social skills to go with his manual skills. He knows his standing and his status. Therefore, he knows his worth and his value. He's got a healthy and accurate sense of who he is, a strong sense of identity. Conscientiousness is often tied to self-discipline and to responsibility. And masculinity certainly involves discipline and responsibility. The self-disciplined man manifests the ability to take care of himself and to take responsibility for himself. Self-discipline is crucial because if you don't have dominion over yourself, you can't take dominion in the world. If you don't rule yourself, you're not fit to rule others. All dominion starts with self-dominion. All rule starts with self-rule. All leadership starts with leading the self. The conscientious man is never impulsive. He can practice delayed gratification. He's principled. He's got firmly held convictions. Good men who are good at being men will gladly assume responsibility for themselves and for their actions, including their failures. They will gladly assume responsibility for those under their headship, for those who are under their leadership. You know, think about a man who gets a girl pregnant, but then abandons the girl and the baby. That's the opposite of being conscientious. He's being irresponsible. He's a bad man who's bad at being a man. Being conscientious means taking responsibility. Taking responsibility for yourself means taking ownership of yourself, including owning up to your sins and to your failures. You take responsibility for your health, for your family, for your finances. That's manhood. That kind of responsibility, that kind of discipline, that kind of conscientiousness. Well, let me wrap this up. God designed for men and women to fit together, to complement one another, to be interdependent, to live as a harmonious whole. We're to be complements, not competitors. We're complements, not adversaries. In the beginning, God made Adam. Then God tore him apart and formed a bride for him, and then put them together in the one flesh covenant union of marriage. The one became two so the two could become one again. That's God's pattern for the man and the woman, God's pattern for marriage. God made us male and female for this reason, that we might be united, that we might come together, that through this union we might fulfill the great mandate given to the human race in the beginning to rule the earth and subdue it, to multiply and fill the earth. Today our civilization is committing suicide because we are rejecting this cultural mandate that is at the very foundation of the human race, at the very foundation, at the very beginning of human history. We're rejecting this cultural mandate because we're in rebellion against God. We're rebelling against this call to subdue the earth. We've got lazy, passive men who prefer virtual reality to real reality and who are refusing the responsibilities of family and dominion. We've got selfish and discontented women who are refusing marriage or who are killing their offspring so their career aspirations can be fulfilled. Look, the reality is, any culture will stand or fall based on its view and its practice of sex. Sex is the linchpin of any civilization. And by sex, I don't just mean the act of sex, but I mean our understanding of male and female, our understanding of the sexes. A civilization will rise or fall based on its view and practice of sex and sexuality. There's simply no way our society can survive in the long run without a return to God's patriarchal order, in which men rule the earth and rule their families, and in which wives submit to their husbands as they manage a home full of kids. God gives each of us a calling. These callings can vary widely. Not all of our lives have to look just the same. That's certainly the case. But we can only have a bright future if a great many of us embrace this patriarchal vision for life and culture. All right, let me stop there. We want to go straight to Q&A.